Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, questions about COVID relief money the state spent on coronavirus tests with the group Test Utah. Petitioners ask Governor Spencer Cox to veto a bill that creates a bank of funds for projects related to the Utah Inland Port. And with vaccine appointments opening up to Utahns 16 and older next week, what do kids, pregnant women, and those who have already been infected need to know? Joining me on the phone for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Alberty. Good morning, Aaron, and thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Welcome. Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens, welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke, good morning to you, Robert.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
And a bit later on the show, we will hear from Tribune data columnist Andy Larson as well. Listeners, a reminder that you can join this discussion with your questions and comments. Tweet to at KCPW or call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Well, I teased this just a moment ago. The group Test Utah has been getting paid by the state of Utah through coronavirus relief funding. The payments are for coronavirus testing. Aaron Alberty, an analysis by the Tribune finds that about $10 million paid to Test Utah was potentially unnecessary. That's my analysis of your analysis. I'll let you explain why that's the case, Aaron. Why was that funding conceivably spent in a way that was unnecessary?
Well, Test Utah, and with its operations through the state, was not seeking insurance information from patients who got tested there. And so looking at the number of tests that Test Utah performed and knowing we received data from the state showing how many of those people tested had symptoms when they were tested, that those in particular would be very likely eligible for insurance coverage. And then if not insurance, if they are on Medicaid, for example, Medicaid was covering tests, and people who were uninsured that would have had, you know, an eligible test. Also, there's a federal fund set aside for those people, though in Utah, Medicaid was paying for that too. So there were other, you know, avenues to cover some of those tests. And the state just didn't seek that coverage. In total, the state spent last year about $25 million for the companies involved in Test Utah. That amounts to about $100 a test. But about $10 million of that we estimated likely could have been recouped if insurance had been sought.
I guess maybe we should get to the question or the answer as to why Test Utah decided, they intentionally decided not to collect insurance information. And if I'm not mistaken, the state signed off on that, correct, Aaron?
Well, yeah, it's a state contract. So in talking to the Department of Health and the governor's office, they had a couple of different reasons for that. One was a communications thing. They wanted anybody that could get a test to go ahead and get tested. And they didn't want people to have to worry about whether they could pay for it, whether they would end up in a fight with their insurance company over it, which has happened. There are federal rules that require insurance to cover certain tests. But, you know, I think many people don't want to argue with insurance. And if people show up and the first thing they're asked for is insurance information, they might give up. So they wanted to make it a very clean message. You can come. It will be free. We've paid for it. There's nothing you need to do. Just get the test. The other reason was that billing insurance is a pretty heavy lift, bureaucratically speaking. There's a lot of communications. Obviously, our healthcare systems that do work with insurance have large billing departments. And in speaking with Intermountain and the U, they did confirm that coronavirus testing in particular is a lot of paperwork because it's a, you know, high volume but kind of lower cost process. So you've got just a ton of different patients being billed for the same small thing, And so that just turns into a lot of paperwork. Intermountain, for example, said they're still catching up on billing from testing that occurred last year. So it is a, you know, it is a big job, and the state said, you know, whatever money we would recoup, would have had to spend at least some of that on staffing that administrative overhead.
So the justifications here are that they didn't want there to be any barriers. They wanted the message to be simple. You can come in, get tested. It's free. And then the administrative costs. State health officials, though, in emails that you obtained, expressed concerns about all of this, about the fact that insurance information wasn't being collected, and about the potential, loss of access to those insurance reimbursement that could happen.
Yeah, we obtained a number of emails, and this was pretty early on in the process where there were concerns raised within, you know, the health department saying this is a terrible deal for the state. And then later, you know, other state offices, well, can we get Medicaid coverage? Can we do insurance? And it didn't happen, obviously. So it's obvious, I mean, it's hard to know at what point the reasons given now became the reasons for not seeking insurance coverage. But, you know, to be fair, there is a big administrative burden to collect insurance. And, of course, that then raises the question, you know, if the administrative burden is so onerous that we would rather spend $10 million to bypass the insurance system altogether when that $10 million could be spent on, say, rental assistance or keeping businesses afloat or PPE for teachers, doesn't that logic hold true for all the rest of healthcare? And that's one thing that, in talking to the Utah Health Policy Project, they were like, yes, you see that this system where we're using private insurance and this hodgepodge of different payment mechanisms is a barrier for people to get care. And one thing that person was like, see, exactly, you get it. So it's kind of an interesting point that, you know, the arguments made to defend this spending are kind of an indictment of the system we have.
Sure. And the advocates are saying, look, you get it. That's interesting. There's this question that I have that was raised by your reporting, Aaron, is in one of these emails that you got a hold of, Nate Checkitz, who is a deputy health director or health department director, says that Test Utah is not collecting insurance information or social security numbers and only recently began collecting date of birth information. I'm not certain when that email is from, but just, you know, before we kind of keep moving through this, how does the state itself verify that a group like Test Utah is billing for actual tests conducted if information like, you know, basic personal information isn't being collected?
Well, they eventually were collecting more personal information, but the state has a system called EpiTrax that all of the test results are now being funneled into. So, at least since August, a different lab has been conducting those tests. So, I mean, it seems that it would be hard for just anyone to hack in and claim tests that didn't exist or, you know, weren't actually done.
Okay.
But I don't know a lot of the details about how, like, technically test result data is funneled into EpiTrax, but I know that, you know, I mean,
right,
the hospitals are doing tests too, and that information is being conveyed into this system.
I'm just going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by tweeting to @KCPW or calling 801-355-8255. And Aaron, you know, you mentioned that one of the justifications given by Test Utah for skipping that insurance question is that it would be allowed to test people who don't have symptoms. You mentioned that just at the outset of the conversation. Why does that matter?
Now, there were federal rules that were set up in the summertime to try to, I guess, clarify what tests insurance had to cover under the, I think it was the CARES Act. Well, Congress had established that insurance has to cover coronavirus testing with no copays to the patient. But then in the summertime, they clarified, well, only those tests that are deemed medically necessary for diagnosis were to be covered, and that would include people with symptoms, and then asymptomatic people who had known contact with somebody who had been diagnosed or had tested positive. And so that was a controversial decision because there were people being told, well, you have to get a coronavirus test that's negative in order to come back to work. But that wasn't considered a diagnostic test because they didn't present with symptoms or any other reason to think that they had coronavirus, so those tests weren't being covered. Or general surveillance, like just for health departments and the public to know how prevalent is the virus, things like that were not going to be covered under, at least not required to be covered. Obviously, insurers can do what they want. So that's why we looked only at people that had symptoms. The state had been keeping track of how many of Test Utah's patients had symptoms when they went to get tested, and because those would, had they gone to a hospital site, they would have been, obviously deemed medically necessary.
So was the state, so you can avoid the problem of the fact that it's going to cost you money to get a test that when you have no symptoms and you haven't been exposed by going to a Test Utah site where they're not asking for insurance information or much else, just offering these tests for free, and then the taxpayer money, this COVID relief money, is paying for them to Test Utah. Was the state directing people who were asymptomatic but who wanted a test to go to Test Utah sites then?
Yeah. I mean, they've been promoting that, for a while. There was a lot of dispute over that early on. There were objections from the health department that, asymptomatic testing isn't what we're doing right now, that there's a high risk of false positive or false negative results that could change people's behavior, either forcing people to quarantine when it wasn't necessary or making them think they were home free and not taking precautions they otherwise would take. But eventually, especially in September when, widespread antigen testing became more of a thing, they basically opened up testing to everybody. And that was kind of when the issue was settled. But it did go on for a long time where, asymptomatic people were being tested and people that didn't have necessarily known contacts were being tested. And there was some disagreement about that. At least early on.
As a sort of policy.
I mean, like, if they had sought insurance for the people who were symptomatic, they could still pay directly for the ones that were asymptomatic. There wouldn't necessarily be anything stopping them from paying directly for those tests that wouldn't be covered under those federal rules and just paying for those and not paying for the ones that could have been reimbursed.
Sure. All of this is what you're saying is choices made by officials on how to spend that relief funding. Maybe this is a point at which I should unmuzzle the news columnist, Aaron, and see what Robert Gerke has to say. Robert, I don't mean to put you on the spot with so direct a question, but $10 million of COVID funding that could have been spent elsewhere. Though, as Aaron points out, there's those administrative costs that, would have come out of that in seeking reimbursements. The question I guess I have is, should the state have told Test Utah to collect insurance information? Should they have sought that route instead? What's your opinion?
Well, I mean, that would have been the sensible procedure to do. We did, as a state, Utah did a lot of things that were supposedly outside the box, right? This is just one example of the things that Utah did that were a little bit, they were done in an effort, according to the state, and I take them at their word on this, they were done in an effort to try to accelerate the testing. Because, frankly, the testing done, or the national protocols for testing were kind of a train wreck early on. And so, the testing was seen as the best tool we had to try to control the spread of the virus or at least figure out where it is. And so it made sense to get a lot of tests going as rapidly as possible from as many different partners as possible. But when you start, the idea all along was that, that people weren't going to be charged for these. It was either going to be paid for by insurance first, and then second, as Aaron notes, from the federal government through CARES Act funding and through federal COVID relief funds. So it's look, they tried something that they thought was going to be disruptive, and it ended up costing taxpayers about $10 million. And you know, it's just one example. Like I said, of the we bought a bunch of hydroxychloroquine that was worthless. We had, you know, the entire Test Utah accuracy, you know, imbroglio early on. And so, you know, it was, you know, I'm going to be a little forgiving perhaps, I guess, in the sense that it was a time where they were trying to move quickly. There was a lot that wasn't known, but this is just more of a procedural paperwork thing that they thought was too cumbersome and not necessarily something that would have sped up or slowed down the actual delivery of tests. And so, it's unfortunate. I mean, $10 million obviously could have been used a lot of different ways in vaccine rollouts and so forth. This is, like I said, just another example of the state kind of trying to take a bold step and then just completely missing it.
Aaron Alberti, we didn't have a lot of time to dig into the background of Test Utah. I think I've had you define Test Utah several times on this show through the course of the pandemic. I think we're going to have to save it for another day because we need to head to our first break in the show. But is there anything else from the story that you want to squeeze in before we head to a break?
Well, you know, looking back a year ago, I think that Robert raises an important point of context in some of this that, I'm actually glad that he raised the point, the testing early on, especially when it really had the potential to do some good in containing the pandemic before it got everywhere, was real bad. Like, we went, and it changed fast in just a couple of weeks. Like, I'm remembering a year ago talking to people who were, you know, storming in emergency rooms trying to get a coronavirus test because they had a cough and symptoms, and it was impossible to get a coronavirus test. And then all of a sudden, the state was begging people to get coronavirus tests. And I am kind of reflecting back about the issue of testing a year ago. Just, it was really chaotic. It was really troubled, and I mean, I do think that is an important bit of context to keep in mind.
Yeah. Aaron Alberti, I will direct listeners to your reporting at sltrip.com and say thank you very much for filling us in on this. And a reminder as well that you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, a petition delivered to Utah Governor Spencer Cox asking him to veto a fund related to the Utah Inland Port is the story that we will turn to, and some news on vaccines and more. Stay with us.
There are so many reasons to support UPR: trustworthy journalism, educational and poignant storytelling, connecting with the world around us, and so much more. These are all very important reasons, but here's another reason that's just for fun. UPR has a brand new art contest mug this spring. This year's beautiful mug is designed by St. George artist Carol Bold, and it features a striking red rock landscape. You can claim one with your early gift of support today of just $96 or $8 a month at upr.org.
This Week in This American Life. For a long time, people have said the SATs are biased against certain groups of kids, and we should not require them. And then, this year, because of the pandemic, most of the top colleges stopped.
My mom was the first person I told, so I ran to her, gave her a hug, we like jumped.
Who wins and who loses as the pandemic throws college admissions into chaos this week.
Tune in Saturday morning at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Aaron Alberti and Taylor Stevens, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This show is a live Friday morning Utah news review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by picking up the receiver and spinning these numbers on your dial, 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Again, 801-355-TALK is the number. Government reporter Taylor Stevens, we will go to you now. A bill to create a kind of bank for various projects passed at this last legislative session. And that bank is for Utah authorities, which are these quasi-governmental entities, among them the Utah Inland Port, which is this huge planned distribution hub way out on the west side of Salt Lake City, kind of near to the Great Salt Lake. The bill that passed, and that, as far as we know, is awaiting the governor's signature still, is creates this this bank of funds, as I said. Explain what this pill does, Taylor. I'm butchering it.
No, not at all. This would create an infrastructure bank. And basically what it is it creates a way for the state to loan funds to these authorities, but only money has been distributed so far or set aside so far for the inland port. And this would be used to help them get roads, water, sewage, power, some of those utilities and infrastructure that can be really expensive and pose an obstacle to an authority like the inland port, which doesn't have that much revenue right now to get off the ground and start bringing in some of those tax dollars and tax differential through the development there.
This week you covered the board meeting of the inland port, and there remains a great deal of public skepticism about the port in general, from what I understand, or from what public testimony at the board meeting showed, at least. And we can get to that. But you also covered the delivery of a petition filled with signatures that went to the governor's office asking him to veto this bill that would create this infrastructure bank you just described. Tell us about the petition.
Yeah, so this comes from some of the anti-port organizers who have been working against this project for a few years now. And they say that the petition has received, I believe, over 1,700 signatures as of Wednesday. And what they say is, you know, they call on the governor to veto the bill, as you said, and allow more time for the public to understand what's in the bill. This legislation was brought forth kind of in the last week of the session, received one committee hearing, passed through, they feel, quickly in the session. And so they want one more public process around the spending of these dollars. And two, they're just concerned about the sort of framework that's been set up around how this money will be used. So they're concerned because the bill would create a committee that would approve the lending of the funds, and that membership would be made up of appointments of, you know, made by the governor, lawmakers, community groups, so potentially unelected folks who would be tasked with deciding how this money would be spent. And they feel that that funding framework is anti-democratic, that it will circumvent the normal public process. I will say that the executive director of the Inland Port addressed those concerns at the board's meeting on Wednesday, and he said that there will be a public process behind distribution of the dollars, both in the communities where they'll be spent, so that would be in a county commission or county council meeting, as well as at the board. But there's no requirement that, you know, this money be spent a certain way beyond just be spent on infrastructure projects. And so there's just a lot of consternation behind the language of this bill for opponents.
I can't remember if you said, but how much money are we talking about when it comes to the money that's being set aside in this fund through this bill?
$75 million right now.
Okay.
For Port Authority projects specifically. And as you mentioned earlier, this also, you know, this whole framework also is set up to help the Point of the Authority, as well as the MIDA, which I can't think of the exact acronym for that.
Military Installation Development Authority. You're welcome.
Yeah. And there's $0 set aside for both of those, $75 million for the Port Authority.
So the governor's office, you know, staff at the governor's office receives this petition, and that's that. I mean, were there any sort of, was there a response from the governor's office on this at all, Taylor?
Not day of, really, just a note from a spokeswoman in the governor's office that the governor would be taking the public comment and public engagement into consideration. However, the governor did address this bill yesterday during his monthly news conference, which I think we'll be talking about a little bit later. But he said there that he is a proponent of the inland port and, you know, definitely made it sound like he does not plan to veto that bill. I will say, you know, there are proponents of this
funding framework and of this infusion of dollars into the project. A lot of people in rural Utah see this as, you know, a positive for bringing some of these satellite ports to their communities. And, you know, proponents of the ports see this as a transformational investment that will really get this project, which has been billed as the state's largest ever economic development project, going and off the ground.
Taylor, I'm going to put you on pause. I'm going to bring in the opinion columnist to opine, and then we'll come back. I have a couple of questions that I want to ask you, actually. But Robert Gerke, there's a petition to veto this bill that creates a $75 million fund for the inland port, essentially for state loans for projects of the inland port. What do you think of it, and what do you think about the petition asking for a veto?
I mean, the governor said yesterday in his news conference that he's going to sign the bill. This is, I guess, a frustration that the opponents of the inland port have had from the get-go, is that they feel like that the public isn't being listened to, that this thing is on, has a rocket on its back, and it's just going to, it's going to blast off. There's political will behind the inland port to get it done. And that includes the governor and obviously the legislature. So while they make compelling arguments, especially on the process for this, like the governor said, I mean, the governor said this actually will be used to make the inland port, to build port projects in rural communities. And that's something that he's been strong about ever since he came into politics. He's a rural guy, and so this is, close to his heart. But it's and that could hypothetically take pressure off the port projects in Salt Lake. So if it goes that route, perhaps it's good. But again, the process starts becoming the question mark, and that's a big part of the concerns that were raised in this petition.
Taylor Stevens, back to you. I feel like for years I've been asking you the same question, which is, where are we on the port now? I mean, is there a business plan, and what's happening at Inland Port Authority board meetings currently?
Yeah, we do have a business plan. My understanding of time in this pandemic is fuzzy, so I can't remember exactly when that was released, but it was in the last, I want to say, year to 6 months that we have seen that. But, at this last Inland Port board meeting, at least, there was no action taken. It was much more informational. And so it will be interesting to see, in these coming meetings, if we do start to see projects actually coming forward. The most of what we've seen is that the port board is developing some partnerships and working on some issues around sustainability. They gave an update on Wednesday about a few of those. For example, one being they want to build a big parking lot for truck drivers who are required to pull over after a certain number of hours, that they could park in that parking lot instead of idling on city streets. They say that would help reduce emissions. Another partnership that they've built is with the Aspire Center at Utah State University, and that would be to create what they are calling a demonstration facility, which would work on demonstrating the feasibility of electric cargo handling equipment. So some of those kind of foundational building block things are going on behind the scenes. And, I think it's always worth noting there already is development going on in that inland port area that was green-lighted before this ever became the inland port jurisdiction. So not a ton of movement that we're seeing, at least at the board meetings, but we're hearing that they are kind of, setting up the framework, this bill, setting up the infrastructure bank as part of that, and I would imagine we'll start to see more movement on that. The other thing we know is that they are still engaging rural communities on this satellite port concept and working to understand, where some of those satellite ports might fit within this system. And they talk a lot about the inland port as a system that's statewide rather than, just the Salt Lake City jurisdiction that we talk a lot about. So that's some of the movement that we've seen, but, very incremental, and we'll be keeping an eye on it and letting people know as more information comes out.
Taylor, I have one just you pointed out something in your article that happened at the Inland Port meeting this week, where one member of the board suggested that public comment could be shortened, and then another member of the board disagreed. Can you just explain that? I think it kind of highlights something about the board and who they are. I mean, they are appointees, and they're not necessarily all on the same page. I don't know if that's true or not, but tell us about that exchange.
Yeah, and so this was, this comment came after almost 2 hours of public comment. And one thing I'll say that's interesting during COVID, when you're doing these virtual public comments, you never really have a good sense of how long public comment is going to go. Whereas in person, you could see, you know, okay, there's this many people in the room.
Right.
But, you know, almost 2 hours of public comment, and they did make some efforts to limit that. They, you know, said that they would only take public comments from people who were there at 4 and raised their hand. So this comment kind of came in that context from a representative from the governor's office of economic development, Ben Hart. And he said, you know, should we think about maybe when we have this many people limiting public comment to a minute or a minute and a half? He said he wants everyone's voice to be heard, but noted that many of those people didn't stay for the full meeting and were dropping off just because of the sheer number of public comments. But Chairman James Rogers, who is a Salt Lake City councilman, he said he wouldn't be interested in doing that as long as he's in charge. He has said that, you know, he has personally felt frustrated at times in legislative committee hearings where he's had only 30 seconds to make a case. And so he said that, you know, we need to hear everybody and give them the full 2 minutes. But, you know, this isn't really typical to have this much public comment at kind of one of these authority. I would say, you know, we do see a lot of public comment at city councils, county councils, but I just think that this board maybe wasn't really anticipating that, at least at first, and we've seen that as a consistent theme at every one of these quarterly meetings, that there's just, you know, many, many people who want to comment on this project who don't feel that their voices are being heard. And so there's kind of that push and pull between getting the board's work done as they see it and listening to you know, full public comment from everyone who wants to speak.
All right. And as you said, you'll be following it. And there's, I'm sure, a great deal more reporting to come on the Utah Inland Port from the Salt Lake Tribune. Taylor, we mentioned the governor's news conference, his monthly news conference on PBS Utah, and the fact that he addressed the petition in that. I speak a little bit about this with Andy Larson in our final segment of the show here, but some pretty sizable news on coronavirus vaccines was dropped during the Thursday news conference from Governor Spencer Cox. What did he say?
Yeah, so he announced that the state is going to open up the vaccines to every Utahn 16 and older starting next Wednesday, which is quite a bit earlier than April 1st, you know, by about a week. And so this is something that we have seen kind of consistently over the last few months, where there's been a certain date and then the state is always kind of moving ahead of it and, you know, under promising, over delivering, I guess you could say. But in Salt Lake County, people will be able to start making those appointments on Monday. Many other county health departments are opening that up on Wednesday. And this, I guess, is in response to, 15% of appointments available for next week that haven't been filled yet. So they say they want to make sure that there aren't doses sitting on shelves, that demand is outpacing supply. And so they are going to be opening this up to everyone soon.
Okay. And that's, I mean, I guess that's good news, the fact that there's availability sooner than maybe predicted. Taylor, we're going to leave it there. In fact, we're going to probably have to leave almost everything there and take a quick break and then come back. Maybe we'll squeeze one story in before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. But thank you for this. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back with more journalism from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune in just a moment.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is supported in part by our members, and Utah State University Extension 4-H, receiving grants from the Utah STEM Action Center for Computer Science and Robotics Clubs in the Washington County School District. The grants will run for 3 years to assist with the challenges of intergenerational poverty.
It's 1982, and Marlene is a successful career woman in Margaret Thatcher's England.
There's personal assistant to a top executive in a multinational. Is that where you want to be in 10 years?
I can't think about 10 years.
Well, you haven't got the speeds anyway.
Top Girls by Carol Churchill, next time on LA Theatre Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, this is Noelle Cockett, president of Utah State University. I listen to UPR in my car and online at upr.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Aaron Alberty, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerke. And we are going to squeeze in one final story before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. And this is a story about water and water conditions in the state of Utah. Taylor Stevens, the short version of this is that we are in a drought, which I think a lot of people know.
Yeah, the governor kind of made that official on Wednesday, declaring a state of emergency due to drought conditions. And, you know, this comes because we had a record dry summer, record dry fall, and our winter snowpack has just not been what we had hoped it would be. We're currently at 70% of normal levels. And so the governor is encouraging people to do their part to save water, and is also making it possible through this declaration for communities that are affected by the drought to potentially access state or federal funds and resources as part of the emergency declaration.
Okay, so urging people to conserve water, urging, as I see from the order, water supply and irrigation companies, or no, well, recommending that they delay the start of the irrigation season, a number of sort of provisions there. Drought, which is tough, but maybe opening up some funding. Robert Gerke, I don't know how to ask you, but drought bad? What do you want to say here?
Well, I mean, I think it should be an alarm for everybody around that we need to be, you know, cautious in the way we use water for the coming months, because as it looks right now, it's going to be a pretty dire summer, and, you know, things can change. But right now, the trajectory we're on, we're going to have some real problems. And so everybody needs to do what they can to pitch in, and that means, like, you know, limiting watering your lawns and all of the things that we know we can do to reduce our water usage.
Taylor Stevens, your article points out that Utah is the second driest state in the nation, but per capita water use by its residents is among the nation's highest. In the drought emergency order, is there any reference to the change in climate, to the fact that climate change is happening and probably and is predicted to play a hand in ongoing drought conditions across the West?
No, there isn't. But, you know, I'm sure that's something that that we know and that policymakers need to begin addressing.
Okay. With that, we're going to have to turn now to our thank you, by the way, Taylor Stevens, for your reporting on this final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight something that, that we didn't cover. And Aaron Alberty, you've been sitting patiently for a while. Maybe I'll bring you back in on this. If you're ready, do you have a pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, we have just up today some more coverage on evictions, this focusing on domestic violence victims. And, you know, we had been in a time where supposedly evictions were less likely, but now we're looking at some of the most vulnerable people, and this is a story by Eric Peterson, Taylor Hartman, Rhea Agarwal, Kathy McKittrick, and McKaylin Jones. So it's part of a series, and I'd check it out.
Check it out at sltrib.com. That was my pick for underplayed story of the week as well, and so thanks for highlighting it. Robert Gerke, let's go to you for your pick.
I was saddened to read this week that former BYU basketball star Sean Bradley was hit by a car while he was riding his bike in St. George and apparently paralyzed. You know, Sean obviously was 7 feet, 6 inches tall, had a long NBA career. You know, and it's just, it's sad to see somebody that, you know, a fairly young guy still, roughly my age, so not that young, but yeah, have to go through something like this, and, you know, your heart goes out to him and his family.
And he was hit while riding his bike not far from his home in St. George. You can find the full coverage of that as well at sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, for your part, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, I'm going to highlight a story from our colleague Sean P. Means. He wrote about some data that found white Utahns are getting vaccinated at twice the rate of other communities and explores whether opening access starting next week to all Utahns 16 and up is going to change some of those trends that we're seeing.
Worth checking out as well. SLTrip.com is the place to do it. As I said, I'm going to, Aaron Alberti took my underplayed story of the week, and thanks, Aaron. And you can find all of the reporting that we've been tackling, again, SLTrip.com or in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can also subscribe while you're over at SLTrip.com. Aaron Alberti, Taylor Stevens, Robert Gerke, all from the paper. Thanks very much for making time for this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And with that, we will now turn to Andy Larson and a look at the vaccine timeline and some groups with distinct vaccine considerations. Take a quick listen. Andy Larson, data columnist and Salt Lake Tribune sports reporter, thanks, as always, for joining me.
Of course. Thanks again.
Andy, Utah Governor Spencer Cox said during his monthly news conference on PBS Utah this week that starting next Wednesday, all Utah adults, in fact, I think all Utahns over the age of 16, will be eligible to sign up for vaccine appointments. That's a week earlier than previously suggested, which was already a stepped up time frame. Just before we jump into the topic at hand, you and I have talked about the accelerating timeline for opening up vaccine of, you know, eligibility. And from my understanding, if I remember correctly from our conversation, this is happening just because the demand is not there. Not enough people are signing up to get the vaccines. Is that correct?
Yeah, essentially, you know, we're basically on pace in terms of manufacturing compared to what we expected. I mean, optimistically, and we're growing week after week, which is good. But in rural Utah counties, and really essentially every county but Salt Lake County, there are these open appointments. You know, it's something that I've been tracking on a couple of times a week basis. It's just going around to different counties in Utah and seeing what places have appointments and where you may be able to get a vaccine. And in Salt Lake County, these appointments have been booked for a couple of weeks now, and are booked a couple of weeks into the future. But in Utah County, Tooele County, Davis County, et cetera, there have been open appointments for the age groups that are already currently eligible, along with those who are high risk. So, if it's only just a couple dozen appointments per day in Utah County with the health department, by next week, that might be hundreds. And so I think that's kind of what Spencer Cox is trying to do here, is say, look, we want supply to be smaller than demand for as long as possible. And so in order to do that, we're going to open up demand by adding additional eligible groups to make sure that we are filling these slots in non-Salt Lake County counties.
We'll see how many people sign up next week. I just wonder how feasible it will actually be as soon as they open it up to everybody that will have appointments available. And I guess we'll just find out on Wednesday. And let's get into a topic that you covered this week, Andy. Some specific groups with distinct considerations when it comes to getting the vaccine. You wrote about kids, about pregnant women, and about people who have already had the virus. Let's start with kids. Right now, you know, people who are under the age of 16 aren't getting any vaccines. And the long and the short of that is because the coronavirus vaccine studies are just barely sort of underway in kids under the age of 16. Is that right? And why is that the case?
Yeah, so correct. So in general, when we're doing these large scale studies, we don't generally include kids because, you know, it creates an extra kind of variable that we're trying to avoid. So when we were studying the phase 3 trials for Pfizer, for Johnson & Johnson, for Moderna, kids weren't included with the exception of the 16 and 17 year olds in the Pfizer trial. And so when those concluded in December, you know, great, we now know that those are eligible for adults, which, as we know, are more at risk for coronavirus considerations than children are anyway. But that's also when we started to kind of lower down the age groups in terms of what we opened up new trials for those kids. So since December, there have been clinical trials underway for the teenage set. So every 12 and up, essentially, in both Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And those trials are expected to end at mid-2021. So essentially, we're thinking May, June, or July. The goal from nearly everyone is to, if these kids can get the vaccine before the school year next year, that's kind of the ideal outcome. And for kids less than 12, then we actually are just recently starting these studies. In fact, this week it was Moderna who came out with the plan to study about 5,000 kids between the ages of 6 months and 12 years old in two different groups, kind of an infant group and a middle-aged kids, I guess you could say, from 2 to 12. So that's again going to take another 4 or 5 months in order to figure out. So we're really kind of looking at the end of 2021 before we get data on that age group.
Okay. In the meantime, just as a reminder, the you know, 16 and 17 year olds, they are eligible to get the vaccine. They just have to get the Pfizer vaccine, correct?
That's the only one that has been tested on 16 and 17 year olds. And so, yeah, they are the ones that kind of have to seek out the Pfizer vaccine.
On to another group with some specific considerations, pregnant women. CDC isn't, you know, they're a little bit vague, I guess, on their advice for expectant mothers. But there are no reasons for any concern about the vaccine and pregnancy, right, Andy?
Right. And again, this is another place where we didn't trial vaccines in pregnant women. And so we have less evidence than we do on the other groups. The difference between pregnant women and children, though, is that we do have thousands of pregnant women who have opted to take the vaccine. And some of those are healthcare workers, teachers, whatever. And quite frankly, some of those are women who didn't know they were pregnant and then signed up for the trial and were inoculated anyway. So what we found through these thousands and thousands of women who have been vaccinated so far is really no difference between them and the population as a whole. You know, they get side effects at the same levels as everyone else, and it's kind of what you would expect. As far as how it impacts their baby in the womb, essentially it's the vaccine never reaches the placenta, but the antibodies created by the adult's vaccine or the adult's immune system, I should say, do actually kind of travel into the baby as well. So we have good evidence of that over two different studies, one from Massachusetts, one from Israel, that shows that these mother-baby pairings both get the antibodies after the mother is vaccinated while pregnant.
So immunity is conferred to the baby. I mean, whatever degree of immunity we get from the vaccines is conferred to the baby once it's born.
Yeah, at least at the very least, they are testing positive for the antibodies. You know, there's complicated T cell immunity, B cell immunity, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't know as much about that. But it does seem in every pairing that we've studied so far that, yes, the antibodies are generated in the umbilical cord blood is where we're testing for these antibodies.
Okay. Well, then on to the final group in your list, Andy, those who have already had the virus. Should they get vaccinated? And then when should they get vaccinated, I think, are the two questions.
Yeah, I mean, so the state of Utah right now is asking anyone who's had a positive test within the last 90 days to wait to get vaccinated. And the thinking there makes a lot of sense is you have the antibodies because you were infected. And so you should save the vaccine for someone else who, you know, will benefit more strongly from it. That being said, the amount of the number of antibodies you get, the amount of immunity protection you get might be greater actually from the vaccination than it is from the infection itself, especially in the case of a mild or asymptomatic infection. And the other benefit of getting vaccinated, you've been infected, is that the first dose acts as the second dose. It's like a reminder for your immune system that, hey, this pathogen is not just a one-time deal. This is going to come, this is going to be kind of a part of your environment. So kind of incentivizes the body to continue to produce these antibodies and raise T cell and B cell immunity levels. So,
And if I can cut you off, an interesting, I think, side note there is that, you know, there's a question about the number of doses needed for people who have already been infected. CDC right now says if you've been infected in the past, or if you've had the infection, you should get both doses. But scientists are saying otherwise, right? I mean, or seem to be suggesting that you don't need both doses.
Yeah, there have been some really good recent studies on this that have looked at previously infected individuals that and what happens when they get the first dose versus what happens when they get the second dose. And when they get the first dose, yes, those antibody levels go up even 100 times, 1,000 times. It's actually pretty remarkable. And that kind of acts as the booster shot, so to speak, based on over the body's previous infection and the immune system's reaction to that. That second dose, which is then kind of the third dose, so to speak, for someone who has been previously infected, doesn't seem to do a whole lot. We don't see the jumps in antibody levels that we do after the first dose for people who have already been infected. And so scientists who run these studies, and again, there have been multiple really good ones from all over the world on this, have asked the CDC to kind of change the recommendation so that you can use those second doses for kind of everyone else who hasn't been infected. But a couple of countries have gone ahead and made that move. So for example, France says if you have a previous infection, you shouldn't get the second dose, but the United States hasn't yet. And so I guess my advice would be to someone who has been previously infected would be definitely, you know, register for that first dose because it will kind of power up your immune system so long as you haven't been infected in the last 90 days. And then keep an eye out on what the CDC's recommendation is kind of in that interim 3 to 4 week period where you're deciding whether or not to get that second dose.
Andy Larson is a data columnist and a Utah Jazz beat reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for the advice and thanks for joining us yet again.
Yep. Thanks again for having me.
You can find Andy Larson's great coverage over at sltrib.com. Find podcasts of this show and all of our local programs over at kcpw.org. This week's Both Sides of the Aisle is worth a listen with Shireen Gorbani, Senator Dan McKay, and Natalie Gochner. They talk about the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, about Representative Burgess Owens' comments on President Joe Biden, the economic future of 2021, and a variety of other topics. You can check that out at kcpw.org. This week's In the Hive is about ICBMs and nuclear weapons. That does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Tune in every Friday morning to the show. Thanks for joining us, and come back again next week.
I'm Jay Allison, producer of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us for our show here on Utah Public Radio with true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world. Moth shows are renowned for the range of human experience they reveal. That's the Moth Radio Hour, Saturday evening at 6, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Utah Public Radio programming comes from our members and the Cache Valley Center for the Arts, presenting Riri Wibri Dance Company, Utah's contemporary dance company, April 12th at 7:30 at the Ellen Eccles Theater in Logan. Tickets are available at cachearts.org or call 435-752-0026.
A statewide service of Utah State University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences. This is KUSR Logan, KUSU-FM Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, Moab, KUST Price, KCEU, and streaming online at upr.org.